Now, think about what that little bitty piece we just saw tells us as we look at the whole story. Joseph and Mary have been traveling at least 70 miles. Now, how we saw it is probably how it happened. He's on foot and she's on a donkey because she's pregnant, very pregnant. Ladies, can you imagine how tired she is? Sitting on a donkey 3 or 4 days, however long it took, trying to travel all that distance. Now, why would they take that trip at such a bad time? I mean, pregnant ladies, as pregnant as she was, can't even get on an airplane today. Why would they do it? Because there was a Roman census. Joseph was required to go and to bring his family to his hometown, which was Bethlehem. And there he was going to complete the census and pay his taxes. Now, imagine what that would be like for us today. April 15th, get the family in the car, you drive to your hometown, and you pay the entire year's taxes in cash. We would probably think about our taxes a little bit differently. But that's what they had to do back then when they did that. Now, as we read the Christmas story, we read there were no rooms available in the inn. An inn would be something like a motel today. Bethlehem was a small town. It was probably overcrowded. There were plenty of other families having to do the same thing that they were. I heard one person say last week, as they're telling the Christmas story, that the reason that Joseph and Mary got left with the stable is because they didn't plan ahead. Well, I don't think that's fair, you know? They didn't have an 800 number to call and make a reservation. The only room available was a stable. Now, we saw a little bit of that stable. That was actually a pretty clean stable, pretty nice. In the area of Bethlehem, that stable was just as likely to have been a cave. And that's where Jesus was born. Did you notice in the video, Joseph, as he turns in and he's looking at the stable, his shoulders kind of slump? You're like, oh my goodness, really? This is my room? This is all I have? And this is all I can do for Mary? You know, I'm very glad that they put that in there. Because the video that we saw just gives us a little taste, and I think that was probably a cleaned up taste, of what it was like to have been there that first Christmas. Because when you stop and think about it, that first Christmas was so unusual. It was so unlikely. 9 months before, an angel had come to Mary and said, "Greetings, you've been favored by God." And then he goes on to tell her that she's going to have a miraculous conception. She's going to have a son. There hadn't been a miraculous conception before, and there hasn't been one since. She's going to have a son, and her son would also be the Son of God. And she was also told, your son will take the throne of his father, his ancestor, David. Now, there hadn't been a king that had a Jewish king in Israel that was a descendant of David for 600 years. The line just got cut off when the people of Israel were taken into exile in Babylon. Then the last king they had, that was a descendant of David, wasn't a good guy either. And Mary's told, your son is going to pick up that line. He's going to be king again in the line of King David. So in the Christmas story, what we have is we have a king not born in a palace, not even born in a house, born in a stable. You have a king who's born to poor parents, poor peasants, actually. This morning we were looking at part of the Christmas story with Simeon when Joseph and Mary bring Jesus to the temple and they have to offer a sacrifice. And they offer the poor person's sacrifice. Here's a king being born into a people that are oppressed by the Romans. Roman soldiers live in their land. Roman soldiers ensure they pay their taxes. And then we read the story also where God comes with angels to the shepherds, one of the lowest class of people. And that's who God chooses for his advertising, to tell other people about the birth. The one plus in the whole thing, I think, is, at least as I look at it, are the angels. Pretty cool to have an angel come talk to you. Have you ever thought how odd the whole Christmas story is? I think we've heard it so many times, it just kind of passes by. We don't really catch the reality of what's going on. But part of what it shows us is that God thinks differently than we do. In fact, he tells us his thoughts are higher than ours and his ways are higher than ours. The title of the sermon this evening is The Gift of Christmas. And the first Christmas gift wasn't an iPad. It wasn't a game system. Dad, you can be thankful it wasn't a tie. It wasn't a book. It was a person. It was Jesus, God the Son, who left heaven and came as a baby. Now, sometimes at Christmas, we hear the word incarnation. You have to catch that first I-N, because I'm not talking about the flower. I'm talking about incarnation, to incarnate. Incarnate means to take human form, as in the person of Jesus, God became a man. Well, there's two different ways that incarnating can be applied. First, to incarnate is to make something understandable. The Bible tells us that God is in heaven and that God is powerful. God spoke and all that we see came into existence. It's only in the last few decades that we've had telescopes powerful enough to tell us and show us that when we look at night at what we think is a star, it's actually a galaxy with thousands, maybe even millions of stars in it. And God tells us he's named every star, knows them all. There's no one greater or more powerful than God. And Jesus makes God understandable for us. As you and I read in the New Testament about Jesus, we see God's character. We see what God likes and he doesn't like. And one of the things you notice is that Jesus does not like proud people, especially religious proud people. He doesn't like them. You see God's character in his personality. You see God's power. At one point, Jesus is in a boat on the Sea of Galilee, and the Sea of Galilee is in kind of a bowl. And there's a certain way, if the winds come down from a certain direction, it can kick up a storm in just a matter of minutes, and it's a nasty, nasty storm. You don't want to be on the water when that happens. And Jesus was in a boat, and that kind of storm came up. And Jesus says, "Quiet." And the whole thing was over. Another time, he's in the home of parents that are grieving because their 12-year-old daughter just died earlier that day. And he comes into the room and he takes the little girl's hand and he says, "Honey, it's time to get up." And she gets up and wakes up. Life returns to her. In Jesus, you see the power of God. And you also hear God's words. One of the things you see most often described about Jesus is his compassion, how he cared for people. So in Jesus, you see God. In fact, at one point, Jesus told some of his followers, "Look, when you've seen me, you've seen God the Father." But there's another way that incarnating can be applied. To borrow a phrase, to incarnate is to wear other people's shoes. That is to look at life or to look at a specific situation from their perspective, which is part of caring about others. Jesus did this. He came from heaven and he's born as a baby. He grows as a child and then a teen and then an adult. He learns his father's trade. We call it carpenter, but probably he worked with both wood and stone. Jesus knew what it was to be hungry and to be tired. He knew what it was to enjoy a good meal, to enjoy a good conversation and a good party. Jesus knew what it was to be human. He wore our shoes. There's a man who runs a Christian ministry, does a number of different things, but at one point he said, "Incarnation is the secret to loving others." And amongst the seminars and teachings and books and other things he does, he has a seminar for married couples that he calls the Incarnation Seminar. And so he gathers these couples together and he explains what incarnation is, what it looks like. And then he gives them an assignment while they're in the group. He says, each of you is to pick an area of mild disagreement. Not big disagreement, mild. Because you're going to be discussing this in front of the other couples. Now think about what that does. That keeps things honest. Okay? Because you get immediate, unbiased feedback. So whether it's the husband or the wife, if they're trying to pull a little bit, people can say, you're being too lame. Or, yep, okay, you got it. You're there. So here's what he told them. When you talk, you not only explain your own view about the topic, you also explain and try to talk about the other person's point of view in a positive way. Now, one particular couple that he mentions chose the topic of how full do you fill the dishwasher before you run it? Now, some of you might roll your eyes. For others, you know exactly what they're talking about. This is big stuff. Okay? So, they have this discussion. And one of the participants said, you know what? Trying to do this, he said, it's wicked hard to do. Because here you are, you're talking with your spouse, and you're talking about something you disagree on, and you're supposed to care about them and show that in the way that you talk. Well, Jesus shows us how to love others well, how to genuinely care. Jesus cared for people in his society that the rest of the people had rejected. Let me give you just two examples. One was a whole group of people, the Samaritans. They were part Jewish, means they were mixed racial. And the Jews and the Samaritans had a love-hate relationship. Both sides loved to hate the other side. And Jews would consider it almost a requirement to be disrespectful, unkind to a Samaritan if they saw them. Jesus cut right all through that. He spoke respectfully. He treated them with respect. And so they listened to him as he talked to them. Another group were the sinners, the public moral failures of all kinds, drunkards, immoral, and tax collectors. Tax collectors back then are different than people that work for the IRS today. Because tax collectors back then sold their souls for money. Because what they did was they agreed that they are going to work for Rome against their own countrymen. And they're going to use the power of Rome to get money, not only to get the taxes that are due, but to steal from others and become rich, because money was their only consolation they had. And it turns out it wasn't all that good a one. If you know the story of Zacchaeus, he was a tax collector. And he had heard about Jesus. And there's a Sunday school song about Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a wee little man. He's short. Wee little man was he. Climbed up in the sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. Well, he's up in the sycamore tree, and Jesus comes along and stops right under the tree and looks at Zacchaeus, says, Zacchaeus, we're doing lunch today at your house. Now, back then, to eat with somebody was to say, you're my friend. So it's no surprise that the good religious people were very upset with Jesus. How could you ever do such a thing? But what was the result? Zacchaeus did a 180. He said, I know I've stolen from people, and I'm going to give it back, and I'm going to repay. Jesus reached out to him. Jesus shows us both sides of incarnating, and the Bible tells us, you and I, to copy Jesus, to love other people the way Jesus loves us. Now, this kind of love isn't talking about us having warm fuzzies for somebody. It's talking about choosing to do good to other people the way God says to do good. Jesus tells a parable. A parable is a story to illustrate a point. We call it the parable of the Good Samaritan. Jesus had been asked, will you tell us, what is the greatest commandment? And Jesus says, look, I can sum up all the commands, all the rules in the Bible in two things. love God and love your neighbor. Now, if you want to hear more about it, wait till we get this morning's sermon posted and you can listen to that. I talked about it some more. But Jesus turns all religiosity, all rule-keeping on its ear and says the whole key isn't keeping the rules. The whole key is responding to God's love. He's already loving. Do you see it? And will you respond to it positively? So, a man hears him say, you sum up the whole law by loving God and loving your neighbor. And the man asks Jesus, well, who's my neighbor? And I'm pretty sure he had a little attitude when he said it. Because the writer tells us this man was trying to narrow who his neighbor was. He wanted to limit who he had to care about. And so Jesus tells the parable. There's this Jew going from Jerusalem down to Jericho. Now, Romans did have some paved roads, but this wasn't one of them. So it's this little curvy track winding through the mountains. Lots of places where people can hide, and some criminals had hidden. They jump out, they overpower him, they beat him up, they steal his money, they leave him half dead. Some other Jews come by, and for their own reasons, do not stop. But a Samaritan shows up, the one that Jews love to hate. And Samaritans love to hate Jews. And he sees the man, knows he's a Jew, and he stops anyway. He patches him up, he puts him on his donkey, he takes him, and he pays for the man to be cared for. Jesus makes the point. Here's the good neighbor, and what we also see is here's the man who showed real love. He met the man at the point of need. And you and I, as we're loving others, at times that's going to mean we're listening to people when we have other things we'd rather do. We're helping someone and being a friend to them when it might not be convenient. And then the hardest one, I think, at least for me, is when I know I need to speak some hard words because you'll benefit from those words if you listen to them and you need to hear them. There's different ways that we can love others. Well, Jesus shows us real love, but his love wasn't just in the past. Jesus is active today. I was reading this week a note that where somebody was talking just about this idea that God is working, that Jesus is active today. He said, I have learned to experience and rely on God's present love, God's comfort, God's power to change me, God's power to change my relationships. You see, you and I don't love others well naturally. We need help. So God doesn't just tell us, love others, and tell me when you got it figured out. God offers us help by offering us a relationship with him where he loves us well, and he teaches us how to love others. And in that first Christmas, as Jesus comes, wearing our shoes, we see love in action. And as you and I experience God's love today, daily, then as we share his love with other people around us in ways both big and small, it's like sharing a candle with somebody when it's dark. And so what we're going to do now is if my candle lighting ladies will come up and light their candles, we're going to dim the lights in just a second. We're going to be lighting a candle. And what I ask you to do is this, is once your candle is lit, just hold it straight up. If yours needs to be lit, lean it into the next person who has theirs lit. And we're going to be singing as we do. Please stand.